So if you've been here over the last 5 weeks, this is our last week of our Lenten series that we've called Letting Go. And we started back 6 weeks ago with this quotation from this woman that we still don't know who she is. She's just a blogger somewhere. But we like the quote. So maybe the journey isn't so much about becoming anything. Maybe it's about unbecoming everything that isn't really you, so you can be who you were meant to be in the first place. That's not a new idea. That idea that we have to lose ourselves to find our lives goes back through all kinds of threads. It kind of sounds a lot like Jesus, actually. And so I was reading a book a couple weeks ago, and this person pulled this quote, and I wanted to go back and read it. It's the last paragraph from C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity, which I know for many of you, like, this is Christian classic. And so for many of you, I mean, this is... I have a special bookshelf of all my favorite books, and it gets to sit on that, you know, that shelf. It has a prized place. So let me just read this last paragraph out of C.S. Lewis. There must be a real giving up of the self. You must throw it away blindly, so to speak. Christ will indeed give you a real personality, but you must not go to him for the sake of that. As long as your own personality is what you are bothering about, you are not going to him at all. The very first step is to try to forget about the self altogether. Your real new self will not come as long as you are looking for it. It will come when you are looking for him. Does that sound strange? The same principle holds, you know, for more everyday matters, even in social life. You will never make a good impression on other people until you stop thinking about what sort of impression you are making. Even in literature and art, no man who bothers about originality will ever be original. Whereas if you simply try to tell the truth, you will, 9 times out of 10, become original without ever having noticed it. The principle runs through all life, from top to bottom. Give up yourself, and you will find your real self. Lose your life, and you will save it. Submit to death of your ambitions and favorite wishes every day, and death of your whole body in the end. Submit with every fiber of your being, and you will find eternal life. Keep back nothing. Nothing that you have not given away will ever be really yours. Nothing in you that has not died will ever be raised from the dead. Look for yourself, and you will find in the long run only hatred, loneliness, despair, rage, ruin, and decay. But look for Christ, and you will find him, and with him, everything else thrown in. This isn't new stuff. Like, this is C.S. Lewis writing in, I think, the early 60s. It's Jesus saying, if you lose your life, you'll find it. That's always, this thing that we're talking about during Lent is what the spiritual journey is always, always, always about. It's always about identifying the self I think I project out there so that you all will like me, or I can control my environment, or so I can deal with my anxiety, that self, and saying, I'm going to lay that self down. And in laying that self down, we call it the false self, I find my truest self. Last week, Chris was teaching, because I was with our formation community, and we were talking about the inner journey, like moving from false self to true self. And that's always, always the journey. And so I hope, we're ending this series now, but I hope that there's pieces of what we've done here in the last 6 weeks that you're able to pick up and just keep carrying and say, there's more to this. And I'm going to come back around to that at the end of my teaching and start talking about Good Friday, because I want us all to kind of prepare ourselves for Good Friday as you move through the week. Turn to Genesis chapter 3. We're going to move towards letting go of isolation, and I'll explain that in just a minute, but I just thought I'd start by reading. And let's just start in chapter 3, verse 1. I don't know what page number it is in your Bibles. You can just open the cover and turn a couple pages. Page 2. Page 2. And I'm reading out of the Message, so it's going to be a little different than yours. The serpent was clever, more clever than any wild animal God had made, and he spoke to the woman. Do I understand that God told you not to eat from any tree in the garden? And the woman said to the serpent, not at all. We can eat from the trees in the garden. It's only about the tree in the middle of the garden that God said, don't eat from it. Don't even touch it or you'll die. And the serpent said to the woman, you won't die. God knows that the moment you eat from that tree, you'll see what's really going on. You'll be just like God, knowing everything, ranging all the way from good to evil. When the woman saw that the tree looked like good eating and realized what she would get out of it, she'd know everything. She took and ate the fruit and then gave some to her husband, and he ate. Immediately, the two of them did see what's really going on, saw themselves naked, and they sewed fig leaves together as makeshift clothes for themselves. And when they heard the sound of God strolling in the garden in the evening breeze, the man and his wife hid in the trees of the garden. They hid from God. And God called to the man, "Where are you?" And he said, "I heard you in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked and I hid." And God said, "Who told you you were naked? Did you eat from that tree I told you not to eat from?" And the man said, "The woman you gave me as a companion, she gave me the fruit from the tree, and yes, I ate it." And God said to the woman, "What is this you've done?" "The serpent seduced me," she said, "and I ate." There's a lot of things we could say about this passage. I've heard this passage preached many, many times in my life, but I want to point to just two things this morning. I know that sitting in this room, some of you believe that there was actually this place called Eden, and there's actually these people called Adam and Eve, and there was actually a serpent that talked. And I know that some of you in this room say, "Oh no, it's all metaphor." And what I want to say to all y'all is I don't really care what you think about the passage one way or the other about that. Because whatever you think about it, the author is trying to help us understand the nature of God and his relationship with our first ancestors. That the passage right before it in chapter 2 tells us that in the cool of the day, they walked in the garden with God. That they had such an intimacy with God that it was as if you were walking with your closest friend or your spouse or whoever. It was that close. Like we were just strolling in the garden together. That was the kind of intimacy they had with God. And the tragedy of their choice, I just find this so heartbreaking and sad that they were created. The language I'm going to use next week, by the way, heads up, going to quote some N.T. Wright next week to you all. The language from N.T. Wright is that we were given a vocation. We were given a reason to be on the planet. It goes back to we were created in the image of God to reflect God's image. And in that image-bearing capacity, they walk with God intimately in the garden. When they live in the way that they were designed, we were designed to be with God. And yet because of their choice, they saw that they were naked and they hid themselves. And God says, "Where are you?" And he says, "I was afraid because I was naked and I hid." And since then, I wanted to go to this passage. It's easy to wag our fingers at Adam and Eve and like, you couldn't just not eat the one fruit, like whatever. The truth is I do these same kinds of choices all the time. I have a vocation and N.T. Wright says, I choose idolatry all the time. And then I realize I'm naked. And almost always the response to our shame is that we hide. When we've done something wrong, we all have this tendency in us to run away and to hide because we don't want to be seen in our shame. One of my very favorite stories of raising our kids, Caleb was about 4 or 5. And you don't probably even remember this story. I told it years ago at Northwoods. My boss, Cal Rickner, used to just cry with laughter every time I tell this. And the boys were sitting out on the deck finishing, I think literally it was peas. And they're sitting out on the deck finishing, and Jennifer and I were done, and we had come inside the house to clean up dishes. And I walked towards the deck door just in time to see Caleb taking his bowl of peas and chucking them into the woods behind our house. And I said to him, I said, "What did you do with your peas?" And he whips around and looked at me and without a thought said, "What did you see?" It was awesome. By the way, those are the parenting moments that everything in you wants to laugh so hard. Like I had to like, you are so in trouble, right? But that's all of us, right? We don't want to be seen when we get to these kinds of spaces, and so we choose isolation. We choose it in 100 different ways all over the place. We've done wrong to our spouse, so we isolate ourselves. We've done wrong to somebody, we isolate ourselves. We feel bad for the things we've done, and we isolate ourselves from God. We choose isolation over and over again. And then after we choose isolation, I think the interesting thing is the next thing Adam does. Do you notice the next thing he does? He chooses isolation, and then he chooses what? Blame. Isn't that totally what we do? I was wrong, I'm hiding, and it wasn't my fault. It was him, it was her, it was that circumstance. I was justified in what I did. And even while we're saying the justification, we're aware of our shame. I could probably, I was gonna spend a lot of time here, and I just think that we know this so well, right? We know our own isolation. We know the ways that we retreat. I was doing some marriage counseling early yesterday morning, or premarital, with a couple that I just met, related to somebody. And we were just talking about that tendency in marriage sometimes, that I talk to couples all the time that might be in a marriage, but they're isolating themselves from their marriage. They're choosing not to say what's really true. They're choosing to keep parts of themselves away from their spouse. And in doing so, they move farther apart. So they isolate more. So they say less and they isolate more. And you know those relationships, right? Maybe some of us in this room are even in that kind of relationship right now. Or it's a friendship, or it's a family member, a parent, a sibling, somebody we know really well, somebody we love really well. And in our shame and in our struggle, we just keep isolating. And so this last week, we wanted to end this series by talking about letting go of isolation. One of our five core values as a church is community. And we say it this way: we believe that spiritual formation happens in the context of intentional relationships that may take many forms. Spiritual formation is simply some people used to call this discipleship. That used to be the popular word. It's just the process, the journey of becoming more like Jesus. That's all it is. That's all those words mean. Spiritual formation just means how I'm becoming more like Jesus. So we believe that becoming more like Jesus happens in the context of intentional relationships. This isn't just, hey, I like this person and we hung out and we talked about sports and weather and the Cubs and that ball that stuck to Molina's chest this week, which defies all logic. These are the deeper kinds of relationships. The kinds of relationships where we choose to stay in them no matter what. I'm going to talk about some of the characteristics of intentional relationships in just a minute. But these are the kinds of relationships that we choose to go deeper, that we make space to say, how is it with your soul? And I really want to know. These are the kinds of relationships where we choose to bear our own souls, where we choose to come out of our isolation, where we choose to come out of hiding and actually walk with others. And we believe that in those kinds of relationships, that's the context in which spiritual formation is going to happen. And I'll explain why in a minute. And then it was 9 years ago that we wrote these, and they've, I think, remained almost unchanged in 9 years. And I remember the conversation for the last part about that may take many forms. At the time, those of us sitting around the table talking about these things were all in a church that the focus of the church was small groups. That we would have said in that church, we believe that spiritual formation happens best in small groups, period. We would have ended there. And what we wanted to acknowledge is that sometimes it's not small groups. Sometimes it is, and I know for, 50, 60 people in our church, that is your, is that right? Is that a good number? 50 or 60 of you, that's your context. But for many of us, that's not actually the best context. And sometimes these relationships look like one-on-one relationships. They look like mentoring relationships. They look like, some of you have been around church a long time, they look like accountability relationships. They look like a lot of different things. But what they all have in common is a degree of intentionality about it, that we're going to go deeper into this together. We're going to choose to come out of hiding with each other, even when everything in me wants to hide. And so we believe then that becoming more like Jesus happens in the context of intentional relationships, and those look like a whole lot of different things. For some of us, I would say this is true for me, my marriage is one of those intentional relationships that Jennifer and I are trying to become more like Jesus together. And so we talk about that journey in us together quite often, in fact. When we go on walks together, we're often talking about, what are you listening to and what are you reading and what's in your head? And it's a lot about how are we becoming more like Jesus as we understand him these days. So I got this far in prep this week and was thinking about, like, so why is that? Why do we believe that's true? And I have five things for you. I almost never have a sermon that has 5 points, but ta-da, I can do that too. So five reasons this morning that I think intentional relationships are the context that we become more like Jesus. And I think this is probably not a comprehensive list. It's just what's in my head. And I've been adding and tweaking all week long. And I hope that I have a little bit of space at the end to maybe invite you if you think I've left something out. So first of all, this kind of goes back to what Chris was saying a little bit last week, is that we learn to sit with difference. When we choose intentional relationships, we choose to sit with difference. Even when people look a lot like us and come from our same socioeconomics and those kinds of things, we still learn to sit with difference. This is a newsflash. My wife and I don't think the same thing about everything. Maybe that's the way it works in your marriage. I would suggest one of you is not telling the truth if that's true. Because no two people have ever thought the same thing about anything. And when I choose intentional relationship, I choose to sit with difference. I have chosen that no matter what my wife and I disagree about, we're going to continue to sit with the differences we have. We're not going to split up because we don't like how each other voted, right? So when we choose the commitment to intentional relationships, we are choosing to say, it might get awkward. It might get really awkward in an election year. It might get really awkward when you make these life choices, and I'm really struggling with how you can make those life choices. It might get really strange that you're raising your kids the way you are, and I'm raising my kids the way I am, and those two things don't collide at all. This might get really strange when you think Genesis is a literal account and I don't, right? Or whatever it is. When we choose, so this language, I want to give you the background behind this language. Last Sunday night at Richwood's Christian Church, they showed the film No Joke, and some of you have been a part of that. So the No Joke film, if you haven't seen it yet, and I think Karen and I talked about where we could find a place to show it here at some point, is a documentary that was shot primarily about the relationship between Jim Powell at Richwood Christian Church and Imam Mufti of the Islamic Foundation Center and Rabbi Daniel Bogard, who used to be one of the rabbis here in town, and he has recently moved to Cincinnati. And so largely the film is about the relationship they forged, and in our community, the friendships that have formed, real good to life friendships between Muslims, Jews, and Christians. And I don't know if you pay attention to the news. This isn't normal in any part of our country or rest of our country or in our world. And so the film is about that. But one of the things that they say in there is one of the ideas about that relationship is that we're going to sit with difference. And I've sat with them when, you know, we've been in conversations together. I've been part of those conversations where we just disagree with each other about a whole host of things. And sometimes it's me disagreeing with evangelical Christians. I say sometimes I have lots in common with the rabbi. I love, the rabbi got me reading Maimonides, which was amazing. But we just keep sitting with difference. When I'm in an intentional relationship, I don't have to cut you off because we think differently about something, like many of us have done over the last couple months in our Facebook feeds. Secondly, I think that what this looks like is that we learn to forgive and to be forgiven. I have a quote now on my whiteboard that I should have put on the slides. Anne Lamott released a new book this week called something. What's it called? Hallelujah. Hallelujah Anyway, and she's writing specifically about mercy. She says, we write a lot of books about grace, but we don't hear a lot of talk about mercy. Mercy is the idea that I grant forgiveness to people, even if they don't ask for it, and especially if they don't deserve it. We just grant forgiveness. That's what we do. That's what it means to be followers of Jesus. And so, in intentional relationships especially, we learn to forgive. I really should have put those a little differently. I was looking at this morning and meant to change it. We learn to forgive, and actually the words I actually wanted there when I say be forgiven is actually ask for forgiveness. That if I'm going to be in intentional relationships with people, I'm going to have to get comfortable with forgiving other people and then being forgiven by them by those people to say, I'm sorry, I was wrong. I'll just tell you a little news flash, a little insight into my marriage. I hate saying I'm wrong. Blame is so much more fun. Blame feels right. So the quote on my wall in there is, she says, I love this. She goes, I do not notice that I am tired and hungry, only that I am right. I love that, right? I don't notice that I need to be forgiven most of the time. I just notice how right I am. I'll forgive you as soon as you ask. And yet, if we're going to be in these kinds of relationships, we're going to have to learn to be comfortable with, I think, what's at the heart of Christianity, the idea that we are forgiven, that we need forgiveness, and that we extend it wherever, in whatever ways we're able, and to keep pushing ourselves to forgive even more. Do you remember a couple years ago, there was the shooting in Pennsylvania? I think it was at a church in Amish country. And at the school, yeah. And do you remember what happened at the trial? The Amish community stood up and said, we forgive this guy. And the media was like, what? And those of us who call ourselves follower of Jesus should have said, like, yep, that's what we would have done too, because that's what we are. That's who we follow. That's exactly it. And yet I know the challenge for all of us, right? Whew. Thirdly, we learn to be loved in spite of ourselves. This comes largely out of my own space as a 3 on the Enneagram who's an achiever and is always hustling for affection. I was telling somebody this week, when I was a little kid, I got good grades, and I was really good at playing the piano when I was little. I was really good at playing piano, and I remember like getting pats on the head all the time about my piano playing and my grades and my baseball abilities, which were marginal, and maybe I just remember them more glorious than they actually were. And somehow in me, part of my false self is that I made that part of my life goal, is to earn people's affection by doing well. And so I'm pretty good at learning to be loved for my strengths. I'm pretty good at, like, yeah, I can see why I'm good at things. I see why you all should love me. I see why you all should think I'm great. What's a much harder journey for me, if I'm really true, really honest, is coming to a space where I learn to be loved in spite of myself. That even on my crappiest day, my wife still tells me that she loves me. Even when I don't deserve that at all. And I think part of this intentional community thing, if we're really going to do this kind of thing, it means sitting in spaces where people are going to say to me and to each other, I know that you're a bad person right now. Sorry, editing. I see that you're in a bad space, and you're all kinds of prickly, and you're saying things and doing things that are frankly hurting me and everybody around you, and I will love you anyway. I think that's some of the power that we see in the recovery programs, in AA or Celebrate Recovery, is spaces where people say, I know you fell down, and I know you fell off the wagon. You will be loved anyway. I was reading, I can't remember when it was, maybe it was when we were doing Breathing Underwater a couple years ago during Lent, that we talked about pictures of Jesus that sometimes, it's so fuzzy. There was a story about a person saying, I always used to imagine that when I got drunk again and I was throwing up, that Jesus was kind of judging me and like, oh, here you go again. And they were talking about their shift in their understanding of Jesus, that nope, when I'm throwing up on the curb, Jesus is the one holding back my hair. And I think, in its best expression, these intentional communities look like that. They look like spaces where people say, I know you're making a mess. I know it. And I will love you anyway. Fourthly, in these intentional communities, I think that we are inspired and challenged. I met this guy yesterday who, I think he was at like 40-ish, took in a 14-year-old boy, adopted this boy. And now this boy is graduating from college in the next month, and his eyes welled up with tears, and he's so proud. And I'm thinking, you're a remarkable, how many bachelors say yes to bringing in a teenage boy into their home and saying, I'm going to adopt this kid and raise him, and he's going to be a great kid, and his whole trajectory of this kid's life, I'm sure, has been radically changed by the love of this man. And I'm sitting there, like, sometimes what I think the thing I get in my job often is I meet with people and I'm supposed to be, like, helping them, and I walk away just, like, so inspired by, like, oh my gosh, people like this exist in the world, and it's a beautiful, beautiful thing. And I think when we get in these kinds of relationships and we find ourselves inspired and challenged, I know for years, Jennifer and I have said that there's just people in our lives that have come along as a married couple that we say, oh, I admire this part of who that this couple's about. I admire this thing that I see in this couple. I admire this thing. And we're inspired and challenged by the people we've gotten to do life with and journey with in this. And I know that's true, not just in our marriage, but it's in my life, that as I get in intentional relationships and find out the battles that other people are facing, I get inspired and I get challenged to do my life better. And then finally, fifthly, I think we demonstrate our love for the whole world. And I think that the idea of proximity matters. I'm in a group. I meet with these four or five, it depends on the week, other pastors. About every other week, we get together for an hour or so. And it's the most eclectic group of people that I would probably have never chosen to be my friends. We're just pastors. They all make fun of me because they all talk about, like, they all wear robes, I think, on Sunday. Most of them do. They're like real churches. They like... Like they do things like right and beautiful on a Sunday morning, whereas I'm spilling my drink and still figuring out how we're going to do the service two songs in, right? And so like it was funny. We were at Christmas time. We were all together, and they're talking about all these special services and things. I'm like, what are you even talking about? And they're like, are you even a pastor? Like, did you even go to school for stuff? And I was like, yeah, okay. I kind of lead a church. But in this, so the group of us, we come from very different theological backgrounds. We have different views on nearly everything. Several of us are white, several of us are black, and it's just this great place where we get to demonstrate our love for the whole body of Christ together. And I love what's happening in those churches today. It's good, and I think I would be really uncomfortable in some of their churches today, right? But it's beautiful and good. And some of you are going to St. Paul's Baptist every Wednesday, and having a Bible study with people at St. Paul's Baptist and building connections there. When we choose those kinds of intentional relationships, we demonstrate what Jesus is talking about. Like, we really do love everyone. We move into those kinds of places where in our proximity, we can actually serve other people. What else? In your experience, why is it true that spiritual formation, becoming like Jesus, happens best in the context of intentional relationships? If I left something out, you won't hurt my feelings at all. Right. To quote myself, I used this years ago, but no, I really, this is important to say, is that so many places in life, I don't think, and I've heard other people say this too, so I'm not, this is a completely original. I believe that we compete over strengths usually, or we can celebrate strengths together, but often we compete on our strengths. Nobody gets to the end of like a boxing match and then says, we're closer together because of this experience, right? We compete over our strengths. We connect over our weaknesses. We connect over our vulnerabilities. We connect when we get naked with each other, not literally, just to be perfectly clear. No small group nakedness, all right? But figuratively, when we actually allow ourselves to go there, then we actually connect at those levels. Those are the people, I feel like in my life, when I've sat with people who give me big me toos, I want to share more. And people who say versions of, well, good luck with that, or, well, I figured that out. I'm done. It's hard for me to want to keep engaging. Yes. Yep. We're built for it. We need it, even if it's scary and hard for us. And I think that's a change. The hard part is part of us wants isolation, even knowing that isolation isn't good for us in any ways. Yeah. So, oh, yes, it's going to cost you something. I was going to say that back on the other side in a minute, but yes, this will always cost you something in time, in energy, frankly, in heartbreak. It just will, all right? It will cost you something. Yeah. What Chris said, if you couldn't hear, was to carry the burden, carry burdens with us, that when life just feels so heavy, a space to have somebody go, I'll do whatever I can, or I'll at least show up. I'll keep showing up. So I want to go, what Janet said was actually my segue to my next slide, is I was thinking about the idea that these kinds of relationships always cost. We can't have this with everybody we know. You just can't. You don't have the time or the energy or the capacity to do this with everyone you know, because they're always going to come at a cost. And those of you that have been in long journeys of small groups or mentoring relationships or something, you know that there's a cost to this. And it's going to come mostly in time, but there's an energy. You're going to have to apologize. You're going to have to forgive. There's a cost to you at some point. But I love this story I heard this week. So I know many of you listen to the Road Back to You podcast, and it's excellent. If you're looking for podcasts, it's so good. And so I think it's the most recent episode. My friends Andy Gullihorn and Jill Phillips are on there. And so she is a 6 on the Enneagram. He's a 9. And they're professional musicians. And so they tour together all the time. And he was telling a story about how he longs for community, and it's hard. He lives in Nashville, and a lot of his friends are artists, and they're traveling. So he told me this summer when we were together about he started this thing. Like, I think it's on Tuesdays. It's a bowling lunch every Tuesday. He shows up at the bowling alley and is just like, anybody that wants to come can come. And they have like 30 or 40 people that show up to bowl every Tuesday for lunch. And they have a roster of like 400 people. He's like, it's just become a thing that we which seems so ludicrous and only something that's possible among a bunch of artists. But anyway, so then he was telling this other story in the podcast that oh my gosh, I loved it so much. He told about his friend Gabe. And his friend Gabe and he go on tour every year together at Christmas. They do a Christmas tour. And he said, every year I get to the end of this Christmas tour and Gabe and I say things to each other like, man, I love you so much and I just wish we had more interactions in our lives. He said, and then we come back to Nashville and we get super busy and we can't keep up with everything going on. And then it's like 3 months to get, and we haven't even sat down and had a coffee together. He's like, and we hated it. So we decided we live a mile and a half apart. They live a mile and a half apart. So he said we decided that every day that we were both in town, we would leave our houses at the exact same time and we would start walking towards the other's house. And when we met halfway, we would just high five. And he said, so what happens now is it's hysterical. He's like, so most days, you know, we walk the 3/4 of the mile and then we high five. But then we usually like talk about what's going on in our lives and chat. And that's fine. That's kind of what I expected to happen. My favorite part is when they're busy and don't have anything to say. Literally walk 3/4 of a mile, see your buddy and go, bam, and then walk back home, right? Isn't that an awesome image to have of these? And if you're the house that is that meeting spot, every day, what? Yeah. But what's gorgeous in that is that commitment to that relationship, right? I was thinking about the commitment on both sides. Like what you get out of that is the commitment that I'm going to keep showing up. And then the feeling of knowing that every day somebody's going to show up for me. That somebody, I don't know how long it takes you to walk 3/4 mile. It takes me about 12 minutes. I'm a dork that knows that. That's pretty powerful. That says something about intentional relationship. That says something about journeying together and the value of a relationship. So the invitation this week is to let go of your isolation, whatever your isolation is. Every week we've given you different ways to fast. And so I want to give you 3 questions this week as we hand out the cards. Here's the invitations. I want on your first card, the second card can sit to the side for a minute. On your first card, I want you to answer a question. And the question is, and wait a second, because I'm going to put 3 of them up there. I want you to answer one of these 3. For some of us this morning, we might need to answer the question, how do I isolate myself from individuals? And when I say that, you might know the person right there, right? For some of you, it's your marriage. That some of you know that in this season of your life, you've chosen to isolate yourself from your own marriage. Or you've isolated yourself from your kids. Maybe another family member. you've chosen, I'm going to put up walls, I'm going to shut down. Now, I'm not talking about a family member where there's a history of abuse and you've had to put walls up for good reason. I'm talking about people that you're in committed relationships with too, that you know, and they may not even know, but you know that inside I've erected a fortress to hide because of whatever. Or the second one is, how do I isolate myself from the church? And when I say church here, I'm thinking of like the wherever two or three gather in my name, I'm in the midst of. So maybe I'm thinking your small group here, but also maybe I'm thinking about this bigger body that you've chosen to keep this body at bay. And maybe part of this invitation for you is to engage here or to engage with a group of people or to engage in a one-on-one relationship with somebody else. I don't know, but I'm thinking church is a bigger thing. And then finally, how do I isolate myself from the world? And this is kind of going to some of the stuff Chris talked about last week. It's really easy for us to stick our heads in the sand and not pay attention to what's going on in the rest of the world around us. And I know there's a fatigue that goes with this, right? There's 1,000 issues. And we can't live into everyone right now. And so I really want you to be sensitive to the Spirit, and whatever somebody else's issue is doesn't have to be your issue. But how are you seeing yourself as isolated from the world? When we first talked about doing this talk, and it kind of went a little bit different direction, we talked about really leaning into issues of like food and clothing and sustainability. Like I've said before, I've been to the sweatshops in Cambodia. And so when I put on clothes and they say Cambodia, I can't just stick my head in the sand and pretend I don't know what it looks and smells like. So what does that mean for me? And how do I choose to live an isolated life in my subdivision that doesn't pay attention to the rest of the world? Or how do I choose? I know some of you are really big about sustainable chocolate, if that's the right terminology, or whatever the thing is. It's easy to stick our heads in the sand. And so here's what I'm asking. Is this weekend, or this coming week, the invitation to fast might look like withdrawing from something, but I think it also could look like engaging with something. That maybe this week for you, if where you're feeling it right now is up at the top one, maybe you are going to choose this week that, hey, I'm going to find space for me and my spouse, for me and my child, for me and whomever. And I'm going to choose to reveal more of myself than I have been. I'm going to open up. And I've been holding back because I'm afraid, because I feel shame, because I feel whatever, but I'm going to choose to lean into this. And so maybe for you, what you write on your card is like, I am going to engage with, and there's a name, or if you're weird about writing a name and putting it up on the board, like draw a symbol for that person or something. You know. Or maybe it's to choose to engage with a small group. Maybe you're in a small group and you're not telling the truth. And maybe it's time to start telling the truth. Or maybe you've been at the fringe here and it's time for you to get engaged in some other way, to serve in Genesis or in Breakfast Club or some other thing that we do here at the church that you've just chosen to keep isolated. And it's to choose to engage some way this week and take a step towards engagement. Or maybe you're really challenged to think about how you isolate yourself from the world and you're still rattling on what some of the stuff Chris said last week. And you need to think about, what do I withdraw from for the sake of the world? What if I withdrew from meat for the sake of the world this week? What if I withdrew from coffee? Or what if I chose to set something aside to put myself in a frame of mind where I'm paying attention to what's happening in all the world with this issue? And so you can write that on the card as well. Those are all the invitations. So let's just be quiet for a minute and you can write on the card and I'll pray at the end of this at this time. God, at times I know the thing I need, to use the language of Paul, the thing I need so much is community, and yet the very thing I need is the thing I run away from, that I choose to isolate myself in my own thoughts and in my own things, and it's hard to engage. And so we want to confess that idolatry to you. That's not the way you created us. You created us for relationship, even when it's difficult. And so Jesus, give us the strength this week to follow you in this. To believe that we are formed by intentional relationships with each other. And God, give us the courage. because it takes a lot of courage some days to believe that's true. In your name I pray, amen.